Welcome to Polycast, a Civilization podcast focused on game strategy.
Dan Q.
Makalua.
The Mian Team.
QNL.
With guest co-hosts
Alexander.
Sid Battle.
As our two guests in particular, volunteer from one of you to do the introduction and the other to do the closing to the show.
I'll do the closing.
I can't even remember the
Oh, sure, Alex. Leave that to the first-time guest. Very nice.
I thought it should be his privilege.
You, of course, familiar with the intro theme of the show. Everybody is. You probably sing it, but don't, because I did that last episode.
I remember.
Oh, boy. It has memories for me there, too.
Don't. Welcome to episode 126. Alexander.
Hi.
Dan Q.
I perceive your analytical forces surrounding my brain. Are you here to foolishly confound me, or are you simply stimulating my intrigue?
Makalua.
Wow.
Makalua. I can't even say it. Makalua.
Who needs more coffee and I think you need less wine?
Me and team.
My analytical forces bring world peace through conquest. So, I guess let's get down to business, huh? We've got a topic picked and everything. Moving to starting settler position in Civ 5, it started by a Fury Crab, and basically, he says, simple question, looking for good reasons you would move your initial settler, more specifically, any reasons you would move him so that you would lose one or more than one turn, and how quick do you feel you get a return on that investment? Assuming you're not reloading and whatnot, because, you know, safe scumming is awesome for winning, but not so awesome for playing legitimately, I suppose. But what are some reasons to move the starting settler losing turns? I don't know. It's pretty rare in all the Civilization games I've played that you really want to spend too long moving around. I mean, maybe you can get away with it on Settler or something. I've heard stories when people are playing those Hall of Fame games, moving their settlers everywhere. But I think for a standard play, you don't want to be caught moving around too long because it just slows down everything. To a large extent, the returns you get from developing your empire early snowball, and every turn you spend not having settled the city delays that entire process from go. Unless you see some really powerful resources that are, you know, just, you know, a move or two away or something that could make your opening faster, I'd hesitate to advocate moving a whole lot.
I would agree with that. I don't think there's a lot of reasons for moving from your starting position unless you really, really had bad luck, got started in a wasteland or something, and you can see like five resources on the horizon that you really would rather have your capital based at.
One thing I saw just now in the thread, quite a few people said to settle defensive positions, and that is a valid point, especially on high levels in Civ 5. The AI does have a bit of a tendency lately to early rush you, so if you want to get some extra defense by settling on a hill, that's a pretty justifiable reason, actually. But other than that, I don't know. Someone saying settle on the luxury for trade. Yeah, I guess you could do that. You usually don't want to use a bunch of turns to do it, but whatever.
And the longer you take to settle your capital, the more vulnerable you are to being booted by barbarians. Now, that's just shameful.
Yeah. Well, it's hard to die to sit barbs in Civ 5, but you can definitely get yourself screwed over by them. Start losing your workers and getting your improvements pillaged, and you'll be set far enough back. But they don't kill you anymore, usually.
If you were spending, like, 10 turns trying to find the ideal city spot, and you only had a
seller. Oh, yeah. That's
my point.
That's
oh, man, I can't even conceive waiting that long. Yeah, but I guess that could happen. I don't know how that works.
In the 10 turns, you would have like one scout, maybe even two warriors or two scouts or whatever. So on standard speed, it would just be ridiculous to start moving around for more than 10 turns, even 5 turns.
Really more than one turn. You know, if you have to move, find you know, the best place you can in your first turn. I wouldn't recommend taking longer than that to find a capital spot.
Always had this phobia about moving at all, and certainly beyond, oh yes, I can move, and I can settle also this turn. Settling on top of a river was mentioned. Getting next to a mountain for Observatory or Machu Picchu, or to go or get next to the ocean from FN Lizard 2, I can see about the ocean. As for the mountain, I mean, that also ties into a little bit to your defense. I mean, if you're right beside it, that is one particular hex that a Civ, if there's that early declaration of war, is not going to be able to get to you on. I can certainly see the observatory argument for that, which is a little later on, but I certainly wouldn't be hinging on, I want to settle this because I want to be able to build this particular wonder. I think that's a little too precarious. Weasel Slapper, oh my. And this is not, I'm not being mean to somebody or anything, or whoa to somebody.
That's an interesting name there, yeah.
I approve of this name, mind you.
He says, if this is going to be a production city, you're better settling off grassland if it's nearby for more production, less population. Science City, you'll be better off with the hill, more population on less production. Maybe as an early game consideration, maybe. I guess I'd never really viewed it in that terms in trying to get it down to a particular sentence. And, of course, they're just comparing, strictly speaking, grassland and hill. But you're also taking into account when you're settling the city, of course, not just the tile that you're settling on, but your potential radius. Then there was also discussions about, well, later on in the game, if you settle here, then you're in a better position to do this. And there was a bunch of math, and I had a fatal exception error in my head. But generally, as was pointed by Brutalist Maximus, okay, we're talking about the capital here, not a future specialist city. Civ 5 snowballs, one extra production in the first 5 turns itself leads into hundreds later, which is very true. I did kind of like Blight Moon's comment, and this is a bit of a side plug for Modcast, which has returned. I found one mod very useful in making this decision much easier. Initial Settler Runner Shoes mod gives your first settler 4 moves.
Wow.
Okay, so short of using mods.
Well, I think a map pack would help, too. And that's a little bit different from a mod, certainly. So if you know where your opponents are that way, you can settle towards them.
And, of course, if you find yourself in a situation where you cannot move, i.e. you're in a one-tile island, well...
Better known as Dan Island.
Dan Island. Just restart.
So I think, in a way, we've also maybe just jump a little bit ahead here to something we touched on briefly, which is about building a city on top of a resource, talked about building it on top of a luxury resource, which, of course, you then have proof the improvement is considered once built, once you've actually reached the technology. So if you settle on die, you get calendar, poof, you now have access to that die. The person who started this particular thread, the Lee, I guess, or the L.
Could be Thel, or Thiel.
Or Thiel, or Thel.
But it looks like the Lee, because of the end of there.
But anyway, he says, one of the best locations I see is next to a river on top of wheat. Is there a downside to building on top of a resource? Well, building on top of a food resource? Oh, I cringe thought, actually.
That's more of a Civ 4 problem, though, because food resources don't have the massive boost in yield that they used to have. So it's not as bad. You still need a good reason to do it, though. I don't know. I like hills. Everyone likes cities settled on hills, right?
Hills are nice. Hills next to rivers are even better.
Ooh, segue!
Yeah, well, Riverside has its benefits as well, yes.
So indeed, Riverside, rivers, how important for cities, also started by this same person. Ooh, tricky. He says, I know that rivers offer big bonuses for new cities, but under what circumstances should I build a city that is not on a river, and that's not in all caps?
The first thing that comes to mind is settling for resources, honestly. I mean, that's why you settle most of your early game cities, is for one resource or another. If you're not getting any of that, it's hard to justify the happiness maintenance. That's all I can call it, is happiness functions as maintenance. It's hard to justify that on cities that don't bring you something back quickly, especially in the early goings. So if you're going to go away from a river, the first thing that comes to mind are the resources. Also, if you're looking for iron, things like that, actually, you can go back to the other thread in terms of the theory here. You can settle on top of iron or horse or whatever and make it pretty much impossible for anybody to deny you that resource, since cutting roads won't do anything these days. So that is something to do. But certainly, if you're going to be able to get a productive city based on the land off of a riverside, go for it. Also, if you're going for like a coastal type strategy, that's another reason, because there's only a select few tiles that are both coastal and riverside. Yep, so sometimes you just need to bite the bullet and settle some coast cities.
The river delta spots are very ideal. At least in Civ 4 for me, my ideal city site, it was a rarity that I'd find it, but it would be on a hill next to a river delta right there on the coast. I used to love building my capital there. You get the defensive bonus from the hill, you get the resources from both the river and from being next to the sea.
Yeah, it sounds good.
And of course, in settling on a river, a big thing, of course, is with, we're talking about your gold income and gold being ever more powerful in Civ 5 as compared to Civ 4 early game, because you can actually, quote-unquote, make use of that beyond scientific purposes, but rush buying buildings, rush buying units, etc. And, of course, you settle on a river, it itself already has one gold, and then if a trading post that just gives you plus one gold. I think whatever patch number that was that gave that trading post that little nerf from plus two to plus one made river settling, at least from a gold perspective, even more attractive. I mean, it's not like it wasn't attractive before. I mean, certainly Bibor says that the question includes so many things that it's impossible to give a straight answer, and a good quarter of this game revolves around city placement. Absolutely. I think it is difficult to give a straight answer, but I think there are some general points that we can give, and we've started to do that already. Shazzy Cat. Non-river sites, I will typically consider at least, and possibly depending upon the location. And this also ties back into the previous couple of points even, topics I should say. One or more new luxury, two or more seafood resources, three or more stable resources, two or more granary resources, lakes, but only if there are a few grasslands to farm and hills nearby for production, and natural wonders. I must admit, I usually don't think about stable resources when I'm thinking about a city site location, but definitely luxury resources and strategic resources.
Stable resources aren't that bad if you have that many, because you have a lot of buildings that are specific to them, and you can get the bonus for each of them then, which is pretty nice.
You know, I think another reason for settling actually on a resource would be if, by doing so, I could gain access to multiple resources within the city radius that I wouldn't be able to otherwise. But usually my cities...
Straight placement.
Exactly. But, yeah, usually my cities end up being in some empty spot that has, like, three resources in the radius, just doing it to try to do a grab on all those.
And there's something to be said, too, about placing a city such that you have access to all the resources right away or quickly, as opposed to having to wait for lots and lots of hex border culture expansions.
Good point.
Because you get those returns quicker then. So, yeah, if it comes down to having the fit cities with the minimum city distance requirements and settling on resource requirements, certainly there's some leeway there.
Another advantage to settling on a river comes in the form of a particular improvement that you can build that you're not going to get access to otherwise, and that's the watermill, or in the case of the Aztecs, the floating garden, where the watermill is going to give you a plus two food and plus one hammer in exchange for two maintenance. And certainly the earlier on that you're able to build those, the better you're going to be off in terms of them. John C. Nunn, there it is. A watermill is always my first building built after I have a tech fort. That tech fort is the wheel. With the possible exception of a monument, yes, actually, when I'm looking to settle cities, if I don't start near a river, I'm actually looking for my subsequent city, the next one, maybe three, number four, all depends on situation, map type, etc., etc., looking for a river, because I know the sooner I'm able to settle those, the sooner I'm going to be able to get that city in place with the watermill, and I'm going to be able to make that come to my advantage. I mean, a watermill is basically a four-production building, as Bibor notes, one from the mill itself and three from the hill. You could work with extra food, of course, assuming there's also a hill nearby, which you're going to want for additional production anyway. And that combined with, honestly, riversite food. I mean, I guess if you have to farm the tile on the river for the food, food is very versatile. You can have that translate into additional production, or you could have that translate into additional science through use of great people if you find that you're lacking for that otherwise.
Hmm. Although translating food into hammers in the very early goings can be a little bit difficult, just depending. I mean, if you don't have any mines to work.
Yes. In addition to not wanting to move around too long because you're trying to find the perfect starting position, if you're really not paying attention and you're letting the turn counter go a little too high into the game, if you have barbarians on, I know it's not like in Civ 4 because you don't have the animals, we just have the barbarians, but ooh, that would be an awful way to lose a game.
Yeah, that's shameful.
As Imagine also notes, in addition to getting from the wheel itself the ability to build a water mill, optimal approach to hit education, Notre Dame and Porcelain Tower, Notre Dame for the happy, Porcelain Tower for the additional great scientists. And if you, I don't know what tech also gives you, Hagia Sophia for the great person, plus 25% great person generation. Oh, and theology for Hagia Sophia is on the same path from, there you go. You're setting yourself up for future growth. You're strong in the early game and then setting yourself up to be that much farther ahead in the mid to late game. There's also, later game, there's also the Hydro Plant, and this came up in discussion as well, where you get plus one production in every tile that's next to a river. So if you have, again, multiple tiles, multiple river tiles, then you get plus one production. But that you need to get yourself to plastics to do that. And because of how late it is in the game, I think, if I remember correctly, Hydro Plants were much more powerful before the latest patch or one of the latest patches. I guess if you're on an advanced start, you could take plastics into consideration, but plus one production at that point in the game, it just doesn't have the same ring to it as it does with a water mill earlier on. And then finally, in this initial cluster of Civ 5 Senate topics, the granary. How much bonus food is needed to make it a priority?
That's another thing where I think Civ 4 kind of had a greater focus on granaries than Civ 5 does. Because Civ 4, you always had those events, somehow one of your cities is starving from a food shortage, and then you can have some city that has a granary send their extra food, but that's not an issue in Civ 5.
Yeah, the whipping as well. And you gain a lot more with having granaries. Like, I think me and Tim discussed in one of his videos as well.
Yeah, well, it's probably not as strong in Civ 5 as it was in Civ 4, just because in Civ 4, it was overwhelming. It was hands down the strongest economic build in the game by such a wide margin that, barring some fairly unusual scenarios, it would be your priority build after a border pop, and sometimes before a border pop, without exception. Still pretty good in Civ 5, though. And like many point out, it's not an expensive building. So not only can you build it relatively quickly, but you get its bonuses relatively quickly, and they can be pretty good, depending on what kind of resources you have there. But yeah, even so, granary is still a very strong option in Civ 5. I've not played Civ 5 to the extent where I could instantly tell you situations where I'd build it over a different building or over a unit or something, depending on how much I need a unit. But it should be relatively early if you're going to receive benefit from it.
To me, it depends. It's not about the plus two food that a granary can give you, unless it happens to be, I've settled this city for a production resource or a luxury resource, and I want that, but I also want the city to grow a little bit in order maybe to work that for whatever reason, if you can initially, so then you build a granary so you can do that. But for me, it's about the plus one food that you get from each source of the following resources, wheat, bananas, and deer. And actually, the deer thing is, I find particularly intriguing now, since not the last patch, but I think the patch before, nerfed the deer a little bit, where the improvement, the camp on it, just gave you an additional production as opposed to additional food. So if you find yourself surrounded by deer, you're probably in tundra, then that makes the granary the more attractive. Again, tying a little bit into Civ 4 granary, maybe even before you get yourself your monument or a border pop.
You know, that's an interesting thought, though. I can just imagine, my little peasants or whatever in my civilization walking into the granary, and there's no big piles of grain. There's all these haunches of venison hanging around. It's just kind of a random thought. I mean, you know, you wouldn't think a granary would give you so many bonuses for, like, the meat items, but it still does.
If it's just for the plus two food, I find that very situational, and I really don't pay that much attention to it early on. If I can actually get that food from working food tiles, either because it happens to be a food tile that's not one of these, like, say, I guess cow or something like that in my head for whatever reason, prioritizing something else. But definitely, the thread talks a lot about if you have at least two of these things. Well, if you have at least one of those plus the two food, there's plus three food. Early on, that's very strong. It's only 60 hammers. It's one maintenance per turn. I think it's worth it then, but it's definitely not every city I have, I'm looking at thinking of putting that building in, like, say, a monument, or like it was in Civ 4. Yes, we need a monument, and we need a granary. I think another element we can bring into the granary discussion just a little bit is to tie it into social policies. For instance, tradition.
Tradition. That was Fiddler on the Roof.
Wow, no chastisation from Mackie. Impressive.
It didn't go on long enough for me to really need to be chastising.
And I'm not Dan.
Yes.
Ooh, didn't go on long enough. Okay, I'm going to remember this. Thanks, Alex.
My pleasure.
All right, I'm taking notes.
But you forgot to add something. And also not Dan.
Details.
Oh, boy.
Because, of course, if you get to the end of tradition now with the policy finishers that the latest patch introduced, you get plus two food in each city, plus 15% growth. The fact that the granary gives you plus two food in and of itself then towards that, because you get the plus two food anyway, but then from that plus two food, you can get that additional 15%, which, oh well, 50% on two isn't very much, except that, of course, that plus two food for your city continue to grow, so by the time you actually finish tradition, then you'll be able to take even greater advantage of that. Now, are there any social policies that give you a food benefit in and of adopting them? I don't think so, unless...
Freedom, the specialists. They cost less food. I can't remember which one.
Oh, civil society. Yes, specialists consume only half the normal amount of food.
That's well down the line, though. So, like, it looks like tradition's the only one for the good chunk of the game.
Yeah, sort of an advanced start.
Yeah, yeah.
I think somebody talked about watermill versus granary as well, and I would prefer the watermill over the granary any day.
The watermill also provides industry, doesn't it? Hammers?
Yeah, production.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think we all in Civ 5 have a lot less trouble growing the cities as we do finding production to go with it.
And luxury.
Yes.
Right.
Some people brought in city-states, specifically maritime, and that why would you bother building a granary when you could just get to friends or allied status with a maritime city-state?
Because with the two food now for costing, what, 500 gold, one granary is cheaper than buying off a maritime city-state.
And then you can use that, if you have that amount of gold, yeah. The granary isn't very expensive, so, I mean, people talk, oh, buy a granary. Well, maybe in a city that's kind of stuck and it needs it to have any kind of decent whatever, because it would take it too long to build, but just build it, quote-unquote, natively and spend that gold on some other things.
Being denounced. And I don't know how to say this guy's username other than go, one, That's what it looks like. So he was 300 turns into a game. When he had friendly relations with the other five civs, he did nothing like settling in their territory, and yet, all of a sudden, with any provocation, they all denounced him and started declaring war. And the only units he says he's attacked is barbarians. It's because, I think it was because they all picked him as a war target somehow, or one person did, and everybody was all friendly enough to everybody else, and it was just like a chain. It's the Civ 5 version of a dog pile.
It's hard to say, like, what exactly caused that from the start without seeing a save game or giving more detail. And it could be something like the AI's, oh, you're trying to win the city in victory condition as me, so now I'm suddenly angry with you, then denounce. And denouncements have a higher impact with friendly civ. Like, the more highly a civ thinks of another civ, the stronger a denouncement. So If you have five people and you have just enough to start off one or two denouncements, that can just turn bad quickly. And ideally, you're not that person who's the target of chain denouncements. But there's some other things that could piss the AI off. Maybe some declarations of friendship expired and weren't renewed in time, or maybe they weren't staggered. So like, this guy was getting friends of friends bonuses the whole time, and they all expired at the same time or something and dropped the disposition wildly. That kind of stuff can happen. All this, of course, instead of declaring war or killing city-states in the obvious, that would also piss the AI off. But also, the SO5 AI is a little bit ruthless, and I think that's a good thing for the game. So if it's trying to win, it can it can screw you over. And some of them certainly have no problem with showing that they're friendly and declaring on you. That's written into the code. They can show friendly and not be, and there's some subtle hints to determine when they're actually not being friendly and they're planning to kill you, like forces occurring on your border or some among other things. But
they're hard-coded to be the devil.
That's certainly something that could have happened as well. And I like the AIs when they try to win. It still doesn't happen consistently enough for my taste in Civ 5 either, but having it play a little more ruthlessly and a little bit more like a cutthroat human is probably a good thing, at least on occasion.
Yeah, they're just doing what a human would do. Is they see your score, they see your population, they realize you're trying to win. It's like, yeah, I got to whittle you down. Let me call in a few
jealous.
Friends for it.
They're jealous.
That's right. They're hating.
They're jelly.
Why are you mad, bro?
Unless you're on a killing spree, shouldn't be getting chain denounced. Unless you were doing something that merits it, you right. can plan ahead and block the denouncing from happening. It's not something that's just going to up and happen unless you're not paying attention.
Well, and also, who are the other five civilizations that he thinks he's cultivating friendly relations with? I mean, is it Montezuma?
Or Napoleon? You know,
or Napoleon, yeah.
Khan.
Alexander.
Exactly.
Yeah.
All of them together. These five guys seem really friendly. Let's all be friends together.
Yeah, let's be friends. Remember, it's not paranoia if everybody really does hate you and want to kill you.
Yeah, that's true. That's absolutely true. And I'm sure everyone wants to be friends. As long as those friends come with a quotation mark, it works out perfectly for everybody.
Yeah. But yeah, we've got this whole kind of cluster of topics here. I guess I would call it how to gain allies and influence players. You know, it's, you know, how do you get them to like you? How do you get them to not denounce you? It's all really the kind of the same principle.
Yeah, that's actually the next topic. Mega Kebab started this one, and then how to get people to like you. Well, be nice. Oh, no, wait. He means in-game. Sorry.
Smile. Make eye contact. Listen. Don't just hear things. Oh, wait, in the game.
In the game.
Use please and thank you.
Wants to know how to get them to be less hostile, friendly, or to get out of guarded status. Apparently, he's been killing off the civilization that everybody hates, and then he's labeled a warmonger. Now, see, I'd love to know what the problem is with that one. Everybody hates this civ. You're the one who gets the killing blow. You know, maybe everybody else has been nibbling at it the whole time, but if you're the one who gets the killing blow, suddenly you're the warmonger. What?
That's in the code. The person who completely wipes out a civ, be it a city-state or a full-on civilization, will get a severe warmongering menace to the world hit. Because of doing it. So you could take like 15 cities and then let your ally or even a city state kill the last city or whatever, but that is very important because it's coded that way. I was reading a fairly long post by JDoc5000. I wish I could find it for you guys now that explained what kinds of things make the AI hate you in terms of this. And basically, if you fully wipe out two civs, even if it's only two cities, if you deal the killing blow twice, you're going to actually overwhelm your declarations of friendship really quickly and easily. And turn into a warmongering menace to the world. So that is a huge point. You do not want to be wiping out city-states or civilizations once anybody you care about knows you. Unless, of course, you're just ready to wipe everybody out.
I believe the post you're referring to, Phil, is actually within the next topic, which is about the related topic about avoiding the warmongering menace to the world label.
Yes, there it is. Post 9. On this.
Yeah, where he looks at the, based on the XML variables and the study of logs, whereas the only actions considered are declarations of war and the final blow in conquering a civilization. Talks about leader warmongers have variables that range from 1 to 8, One without with standard personalities, not doing the random personalities. One is Monty, and eight is I'm just going to call him Rami of Siam, lest I try to pronounce his full name and butcher it. And he says, including all the DLC, the current distribution is really just limited to 4 through 7, and then he shows from 1 to 8 the number of leaders that have that variable, and they can be adjusted up or down by 2 points in a particular game. And all AI personalities are variable. Essentially, not on random personalities, you've got the defenders of the free world, Rami, Gandhi, Elizabeth Washington, and I'm going to call him Cammy for Polynesia, just because it rhymes with Rami. And the Do What You Like, 3 and under, from Montezuma, Alexander, and Napoleon. And this gets, I think, to the user interface issue, and this is actually what bothers me, not so much these are the mechanics, although, yeah, we could look at that, but it's the fact that, for instance, if you declare war twice or you conquer a city-state or a sieve, so as Phil was getting at by taking that very last city, you do either the above actions or both, and you get to a major in terms of your warmongering menace of the world. And then you have to play very, very nice to avoid getting this label completely.
So you have to sit there and game it by not conquering the last city or not taking out a city-state, which is just kind of stupid.
Yep.
It can make getting a domination victory a little trickier. I think there was actually a discussion here. No Kermit says, my God, man, how are you supposed to win a domination victory? And Shazzy Cat says, you're not. Not if you care about your reputation.
I think I have to go with the Phil and Madjin strategy. You don't like me, have a worm nuke.
So that way the number of turns in the game, you actually have that penalty, limited?
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, I've got most of the world. Screw you guys, have a nuke.
But, I mean, there really is, only so much you can do if you're going to be a fighter in Civilization. On a macro level, I mean, the two-step program for getting other civs to like you in Civilization, step one is to go into Control Panel and uninstall Civilization 5. Step two is to install Civilization 2 or lower. You know, I mean, in recent civs, they just are not going to like a fighter. At least
in
you.
No, there are ways to do it. I think in both Civ 4 and 5, if you can bait people into declaring war on you while holding a bunch of declarations of friendship and not deal any killing blows in Civ 5, for example, you'll have people reasonably liking you, especially if you hold your declarations of friendship and don't massively overexpand early game, things like that. They'll still like you. And in Civ 4, certainly with the religion mechanic, you could just make BFFs like nothing out of the Zealots. And even out of using the favorite civic bonuses, as long as you didn't do anything that they severely disliked, like declaring on them or trading with their worst enemy, which is only one civ for each of your other civs that you're trying to negotiate with, you could also get like huge friendly relations and hang on to that the entire game while warring. I mean, as long as you're not declaring on people they like, you can capture as many cities as you wanted, and it didn't matter. And now that they changed the city capture mechanic in Civ 5, I'm pretty sure it's different from how it used to be. Because it used to be somebody would declare on me in Civ 5, and I'd start taking cities, and that would make me a warmongering menace, even though I never declared war myself. So I'm guessing that this information from JDog is from one of the newer patches, or at least, you know, since March or something. I haven't really checked that since then in terms of the code itself. But, you know, with that the way it is now, you can get pretty far along in the game and capture a lot of cities before people start hating you.
Yeah, I'd call that strategy like the defensive offense, where you're just like constantly poking the AI again and again and again until he just loses his cool.
Yeah.
In this thread, Slacker Pants.
I like this name. I approve this name the way Phil approved the other name.
I approve this name also, mind you.
I'm the only one who actually likes the diplomacy system here and feel the previous games have been too forgiving. First, if a country declares war in real life, the rest of the world will naturally react to it and probably not in a good way. Second, it helps to balance the game slightly away from war. And third, it gives, at least I think, the diplomacy some more finesse, since you can more easily create alliances against warmongers, not forcing you to always match all other nations' military, quote-unquote. I think to me that even ties into, let's start with, before we even get to changing the mechanics, if we get able to agree on that, the user interface, back to the user interface, and are you considered a warmonger menace to the world? Is that minor or major? Because if it's major, you may decide either I'm going to back off for a little while.
I'm pretty sure that just sticks. I don't see anything from JDog that it goes away, and that's kind of important information. I don't think he would leave it out.
Okay, so either you're at major, so now you're thinking, okay, I need to try to come up with some positive things that I can do in terms of improving my relations before I then decide to continue on my warmongering path, whether it's actually for a domination victory, or if you're thinking, I don't want to go for a domination victory, I want to go for a science victory, but this person's science is comparable to mine, I have a slight military advantage, or I need to wipe them out before they get there or really start to compete with me for that. The Slacker Pan says, you can make allies, and it's useful if you pick the right ones. It's nearly impossible to keep an alliance through an entire game, and it seems you're saying that's what you're looking for. The AI do ally and backstab each other anyway, quote-unquote, and they will also do that to you. I must admit, the first couple of times I was backstabbed that they actually used that word, and now in the diplomacy you can actually see bold block letters, backstab. Is this kind of like, ugh. To get to help people to like you. If Sid comes to you and says, hey, can you give me this amount of gold up front? Things aren't going too well over here, or often in Civ 5 I find it's not so much give me gold, but it's, hey, give me this resource. You can say yes. I do that a lot more than I used to. I just used to outright say, screw you, what's the advantage to my giving you something for nothing? Well,
really, rebuild the game and sell it.
Really, it's schoolyard politics rather than proper diplomacy. It's, you know, give me your lunch money. You know, I don't like Genghis Khan because his parents buy his clothes at the Gap. That's kind of the level of...
Something that was very broken in Civ 4, and I think it's still around in Civ 5, where if you want one side to hold up against another side that's overwhelming it, and you have nukes, just give the nuke over. They'll fire the nuke, kill off a lot of units, and all of a sudden the war is more equalized. And you just keep doing that to keep the war going on forever. And as far as I'm aware, the diplomatic penalties for that are so minimal is that they're hard to even observe, which that is just hilarious.
That should have a bigger diplomatic penalty.
Yes, it should.
Again, just imagine.
Other sides in general should be a big diplomatic penalty.
Just imagine
like
there's two small African countries at war with each other, and the United States decides to back one. Here, have a nuke. Here, have another nuke. Here, have another nuke. You know, just imagine how quickly, you know, things would spiral from there.
We'll just offload to you all of our surplus, old, out-of-date military equipment.
Yeah, exactly.
That sounds familiar. Where have I heard this before?
In real life a few times too many.
Wink, wink, nudge, nudge.
Okay, so maybe the diplo penalties for it are realistic. Not that I think that's good for gameplay. I think from a gameplay standpoint, there definitely should be huge penalties for this. Because, again, just think about how a competent player would react to one side gifting the other unit so that it could fight you. I mean, obviously, you would look at that as, okay, these two people are allied against me. And, you know, that could be a completely valid thing for both sides to do, but you now consider them both enemies for obvious reasons. I should do that, too. I swear that I did not have nuclear gifting relations with that ship.
Beware, our words are backed with nuclear weapons.
Where did you get those nuclear weapons? You don't even have education, Miller.
There's this fourth thread. We've essentially got two sets of four topics here, interrelated. This is selling lost cause, air quotes, cities. Good idea. Specifically, selling a city that's being attacked that you have no chance of saving from Wildcat 67. Hardly a new idea for the Civ franchise.
Here, take the city up in the tundra, please.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was even thinking more of just gifting. Here, enjoy.
Your problem
your
now, buddy.
Economy go, I didn't just sell you a miniature black hole, did I?
The economy, uh-oh. I think more about in terms of Civ 4 than Civ 5.
Right.
Yeah, but
still.
Yeah.
If it's a big drain on your economy, more than like a military liability.
Now, Eric in the thread does say that he prefers to use such cities as a buffer against more important cities deeper in the territory. It can slow down an invading force and give you time to redeploy if necessary. Yeah, it's all situational here. But what if you don't have any more forces to redeploy?
Give you time and give you money to get at least another unit or so in your city sale.
Exactly.
Basically, you're guaranteed to lose it. There's not a whole lot I see. Well, I mean, if you want it back ultimately, and it's a problem declaring on the person you're selling it to, then that's the only drawback. If that's not a non-factor, then there's not a whole lot holding you back from selling it, aside from the people arguing on the thread that it's cheap. But other than that...
It also depends on your goals while you're... I mean, like, the strategy you're pursuing. You know, are you a builder? Are you trying to go for a space victory? Because if you're trying to pursue a domination victory, you should just reload, because why are they taking your cities if you're trying to dominate? But...
You can get caught out of position, although generally you just come back and recapture it then.
Exactly.
But sometimes it takes a while to shift your forces from one side of the empire to the other.
There's a difference between, you know, picking your battles and just outright losing.
Yeah, well.
If they're running over your cities, I mean, you're too far gone anyway, but.
And they being AI, of course.
Yes, yes.
Not, hey, you just rolled over my SIP. Can we reload the MP game?
Oh, gosh.
Yes.
next time, let's have you not take my city, Dan.
In all fairness, though, this tactic has been banned in some multiplayer games in SIP 4 in the past. It is kind of bothersome to have it. And certainly the game could treat it better than it treats it. For example, it should count as an act of war to buy a city in that situation. It's essentially a de facto alliance between the war target and the person he's selling the city to. It should not expel units automatically, and it should result in war. That's what it's basically doing. You are denying your opponent an opportunity to capture resources by giving them to somebody else and letting them defend it. And that should not be taken as a neutral action, which it is in-game. And probably the biggest problem with it is that it just expels units outright, which you should never be able to forcibly expel enemy units from like that while you're at war. It's just ridiculous.
Well, just think about that in an applied sense. You know, the German panzers are rolling into Paris, and the French say, sorry, we sold Paris to Great Britain. You can't be here anymore. You know, I mean, it's just ridiculous.
It just teleports them. They don't just leave. They teleport.
They teleport.
Hundreds of miles back east.
Zip, zap, zoop, gone.
And, of course, Germany has no problem with this. They're not going to go after France now because they sold their city to England. Yeah.
Oh, it's okay now. Oh, you've sold
not
it.
Not that
oh.
I like the realism arguments here, though, but even so, it breaks everything. It breaks realism and it breaks gameplay. And for me, the bigger hurt is gameplay. It's just ridiculous that you can do war actions without drawing war. And that certainly is a war action. No doubt about that. Yep. Not to mention the effect it has with one unit per tile and chokes going around. Oh, God. Or the ability to attack if you have open borders with the third party and the other side doesn't. Attack from there without being retaliated or going to war.
Jeez, yeah, that should so be considered bad. An act of war as well.
Actions speak louder than words, and they should.
Yeah.
You know what I would like to see? I mean, as a hypothetical, a United Nations mechanism that functioned kind of like the Alpha Centauri, I guess, United Nations equivalent.
The Planetary Council.
Yes, the Planetary Council, where you see all of your leaders on this panel, and they're all, you know, discussing and hating on each other, but like politicking, you know, backstabbing politically rather than drop a nuke on them, you know.
I don't really remember the mechanics of that well, because I never played Alpha Centauri at, like, high levels or competitively or anything like that, so I'm not really sure how that functioned. Like, what kind of diplomacy are you suggesting here?
Well, you could, if you knew, like, that the vote for deciding who was the leader of the council was coming up, you could contact him a couple terms before and say, I need your vote in this something on the council. That you could even do that with, if you were going to bring up a proposition, like, to do... Kind of like with the, what's the Civ 4 stuff? The resolutions, where you were like a global currency or something. You know, you'd contact them, you could bribe them or whatever, ask for their vote if you were on good terms, and they would actually come to. And they didn't, AI would be rolling to see whether it was actually going to do that or not. You couldn't necessarily depend, even if you bribed them, that they were going to vote that way.
Hmm.
So, it could be very interesting.
Yeah, it was pretty versatile.
But the chance then that they would vote for it, was that purely chance then? A random roll? Or was there actually like...
There was probably a math to it, but I don't think I've seen the numbers. I don't think there's enough people that play that dug into the numbers enough, or yeah. At least that I've seen.
Okay.
You had the same mechanic in Civ 3. If you traded or bribed or everyone liked you, they would vote on you for the UN.
Yeah, it was partially based on your
I'm
prior relationship.
I'm suspicious of this code, though, because we are talking about the same kind of developer that made the UN code in Civ 4, where it is transparent, and basically the AI would call a resolution at random, as long as it's an eligible resolution. It would just roll the dice and pick one when it didn't weight it at all.
Yeah, that seems a little bit...
I don't know, maybe that bribing influences their chances to vote in favor of something that they would otherwise not vote. I'm sure it did, but I'm not sure how in-depth it really got. I would like to see that, though, diplomacy actually mattering in terms of that, and have it be sensible, though, not just mattering in terms of RNG outcomes, completely random, without any influence. I'd like to see some strategy there.
Because you had both the flat yes and no votes for some of the proposals, and for things like planetary governor or their version of the UN when it was... you had a population vote count. So you actually, literally, if you had a big enough empire, you could just vote yourself in via population. I mean, it was neat, but it was also ludicrous sometimes.
Yeah.
Yes.
But yeah, I'd like to see a panel where you can...
Domination diplomacy.
Diplomacy domination. Wait, a panel where you could see, the little avatars of each of your opponents and maybe a little thing underneath saying what their intentions are, what they're proposing. And have it actually line up with what they've been doing so far in the game, not just a random. I mean, like, I've actually had, the warmonger like Montezuma propose, nuclear non-proliferation treaties in things like Civ 4. Like, just because it's there. And then the next one, like, they voted out again, and then back to like, this makes no sense. This is silly. You know, it shouldn't take all that much effort to get them to actually behave in a sensical fashion.
Have it weighted, yeah, not be completely random.
Yeah, Montezuma should have a very low weight for bringing up the nuclear non-proliferation because he is a warmonger.
Exactly.
Any warmonger should weight that lower and weight things. I don't know, maybe they would like global currency because that gives them more stuff, trade routes.
Gives everyone more stuff. I think nuclear non-proliferation should be a resolution that's favored very much by civs that are backwards or not near nuclear arms, and especially as other civs get near them. Once somebody has nukes, if they use them, there's no hope. It's not like you're not going to research 10 turns and then build Manhattan Project if someone already has nukes. You're done.
Yep.
Never finishing Manhattan Project or anything else, never finishing any nukes. You're done. You're going to die.
You know, I'd also like to see diplomatic decisions weighted in favor of a particular civics or social policies for Civ 5. You know, where they behave in a manner congruent with whatever social policy they've adopted.
Yeah, if you're in liberty or something like that, why are you voting for restrictive things?
Uh-huh. And if you're in, like, fascism or communism, why are you being such a nice guy?
Yeah.
Or even if you happen to be a power that's capable of constructing nuclear weapons, but you haven't yet, and you get declared on and nukes are used against you, then you can push for a non-proliferation treaty. And I think with the non-proliferation, I've seen some people, on that particular point in particular, I've seen... some people get really upset that if that passes, then you cannot build nukes. And then Civ 5, it's like, well, there is no option to propose that. So I think maybe a compromise between those two, and then you can also get into the weighted factors too, as long as it's still not a random roll, is you can put that resolution forward, and maybe you can still build nuclear weapons, but if you do that, then the probability is high that the turn after you do that, then everybody just unites then against you and declares war. Now, whether or not that then turns into something practical, like perhaps maybe you're the only one with nuclear weapons, there's a non-proliferation treaty come up, you sign it to make people not immediately not happy with you, but you figure nobody else is going to be able to touch me. They can get all pissy and declare on me if they want. They're not going to be able to do anything. But I think that, for that particular mechanic, that would help flush that out. Somewhere in between of, holy crap, there's no way to address this. As soon as somebody gets nukes, lookout, screw job in Civ 5, as opposed to you've completely eliminated the possibility in Civ 4.
Yep.
Yeah, nothing makes you want to vote for non-proliferation more than you're getting close to a victory and suddenly everybody's completing the Manhattan Project in Civ 5 and you're like, oh, shit. Quick, launch, launch. Well, I had that happen in a game the other day. I think it was Germany and somebody else suddenly built the Manhattan Project almost out of nowhere, and I was about halfway done with the spaceship, and I said, oh, crap, I know what they're planning. Quick, build.
That's an interesting thought. You know, like you're launching your spaceship, and then they launch their nukes and nuke your spaceship out of the sky. That would be depressing.
Not my spaceship.
Watch your capital. Your spaceship crashes, even though it was in space.
Game over.
Yeah, that was stupid.
Game over. You went through all of this just to lose. Sorry.
Yeah, you conquer Washington, the shuttle's going to go off target. Whoops, no, that's not where the control for the shuttle is, dum-dums.
The control is in another castle.
Uh-huh.
Question. Does Civ 5 still have that issue where open borders expires way too often?
Yes, it always expires. You must annually renew. Yeah.
It does not auto-renew, sadly.
Oh, boy. I just remember that from last time I played it.
I know. I can kind of see the point in it when it's single player, but in multiplayer, I would really like it if I could tag a little thing that says, I want this to auto-renew. Yeah. If I have open borders with Dan, I don't want to have to go every 30 turns and reopen my borders with Dan.
Especially in a cooperative situation where you want to, all right, we got to take out this Civ on...
His army is halfway across my territory and suddenly open borders expires.
Yeah.
The genie took them on a magic carpet ride and now you're...
Yeah. Also makes me wonder if they couldn't implement some kind of higher diplomatic function, like having an alliance. Like, I think Civ 2 was the last one that actually had a really good alliance function. But, you know, if you're entering into an alliance with another player, whether AI or human, that could indicate you want permanent open borders with this individual, permanent defensive pact.
Yeah, there's permanent alliance in Civ 4, but you have to go way up the tech tree to get it.
Well, plus that just merges you with one other player.
Right. You couldn't sign multiple alliances. You couldn't make a triad going or something like that.
No, you couldn't have an entente or, you know, any sort of power block, which was unfortunate.
That would be interesting in diplomacy from the AI side, too. They've been signing declarations of friendship for however how many turns it turns into an alliance.
Yeah, and you've got this axis of evil with Montezuma, Napoleon, Genghis Khan.
The rest of the free world.
I mean, you can reflect that in some way, quote unquote, outside of games, but in a multiplayer situation, you know, when talking to people about, okay, yeah, I'm going to permanently ally with Joe, you're going to purposely ally with Jane, but we're all working together as one. But yeah, that mechanism in and of itself not exist in the game.
Yeah, in multiplayer, we can talk about what we're doing and keep doing it automatically, but it's nice when we have the in-game mechanics to support that.
Yes. You don't have to constantly worry about the micromanaging of something that isn't what you're playing the game for.
Why so many city-states want each other dead, and perhaps we can tie this into an earlier topic, they want to troll the quote-unquote proper citizens in the game to see who can get them to being labeled a warmonger. Who can we sucker in to get themselves declared warmonger first?
Yeah, man, I hate those guys anyway, so let's see if one of the bigs will do it for us.
As if it's not already skewed towards the military, they're trolling you for fighting. And I think every city-state is hard-coded to have a nemesis or two, you know, and so they're always going to be hating on some other city-state no matter what, and they're always going to be begging you constantly to be a warmonger and wipe them out.
Well, I mean, that's just kind of human nature, right? I mean, we all have to have our enemies. How else do we know we're either good or evil?
It gets tiresome, I think, especially if you have, 12 or more city-states on your map, and you're getting, six requests a turn. Kill them now!
You know, like earlier on in some patches, they'd say, hey, please build a road. And then there was that completing the road issue for influence, and it was broken. And then they fixed that, and then the requests for the roads suddenly, they're still around, but they're less frequent than they used to be.
Yes. Find us a wonder, get this resource, there's a road, but the majority of it is, kill it!
Once a city-state says, we want you to kill this city-state, that's the last request or quest, as has been phrased in the thread, the city-state will make until from then till the end of the game.
Yeah, they won't change their minds on it.
They will only if there's barbarians or somebody else starts declaring war on them.
Okay, no exceptions.
You can get the quest to kill X amount of units.
So the only exception to a request for war is an actual war.
Yeah.
A real war.
Call in today. In North America, the number is 301-637-7659.
That's 301-637-POLY.
In Europe, 44-121-288-7659. That's 44-121-288-POLY.
You can Skype us at ThePolyCast or email us at ThePolyCast@gmail.com.
The only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about.
For more information on Polycast,
our sibling shows Modcast and Revcast,
or about Polycast in general,
log on to the series' official website at thepolycast.net.
Chances are most people think like people.
Yeah.
And respond in like manner.
People think like people. Wow.
Oh, yeah. You can't get more pointed than that.
You've totally blown my mind with your blatant simplicity.
Oh, yeah. Let me help you pick up the pieces.
Simple Dan. That is a deep thought right there. I awarded him a deep thought medal. I'm giving him a medal. An e-medal.
An e-medal.
I'll email it to you. Just send me your email address along with your social security number and bank.
I promise there's not a virus in it.
No. I'm like the Prince of Morocco or something. I just need your help. I'll just send it to me.
I promise there's no virus in it because I've already delivered it to you.
We here at the podcast do accept donations to make this a better podcast.
Yeah, you managed to say that full sentence before you started to laugh, Alex. Well done on the first go-to. Good job.
It's a 1,000% pay raise right there. 1,000%.
1,000 times zero is still... Wait, what?
Yeah.
Wait. You know, Anna Lee pointed this out a few episodes ago about multiplying by zero. Like, why are you pointing this stuff out? Is this like a conspiracy if you two point these things out?
It's not a conspiracy if you're married.
Just don't divide by zero.
Dividing by zero is the secret to being good at Civ games, actually. I don't think we should out that just yet.
Well, you've been listening to Polycast, episode 126, a joint venture of Civilization Anonymous and the Canadian League of Women Voters. Civilization Anonymous. You won't stop playing until you want to stop playing. Today's participants have included Dan Q.
The positioning of your analytical forces is somewhat worrisome. I advise you to withdraw for the sake of future sanity.
Makalua.
I would respond to that, but I think it belongs on Polycast After Dark, so yeah.
The me and team.
If you're in trouble and need some anonymous nuclear relations, be sure to contact me at 555-NUKE.
Civ Battle.
I think too much. That's why I don't talk.
And I'm Alexander, or at least people tell me I used to be. Signing off.
So if that's what you're going for, then Granary giving just the fact that the granny gave... The granary...
Easy there.
For grannies.
No, Mackie.
I only heard part of that because I was too busy laughing. Maybe it's just...
This is Polycast during the day, Mackie. During the day. Easy.
Oh, gosh.
And we're all busy looking in the chat, which makes...
we're supporting both audio and visual. We are providing visual stimulation to our listeners through our channel. So I've got to keep up with what's going on.
Visual stimulation. So
if goes live, that we'll check you out, and you can check us out, too.
We love our lurkers, too.
Hey, yes, we do. Yes, we do, because then they can't come. No.
Dan,
oh,
I'm trying to say something nice, and what do you do to it?
Face palming.
I didn't say anything, so I'm innocent. I'm calling an O.
Wow.
I'm too young for this.
Wow. All right, listeners, you just go and enjoy Mackie saying that, because I don't think that's going to be the version.
trying to encourage people to check out our live chat during the show, and look what happened.
So, do we want to move right along, then?
I think that's a good suggestion.
Record date August 6th, 2011. Civilization 4, 5, and World Sound Clips. Copyright Take 2 Interactive. Copyright Civilized Communication at civcom.net.